When you finished at Harvard, you went to England.
Yeah.
And
I went with Alex Todd. Todd was at that time visiting at MIT. He was giving lectures at MIT, which I went down to. And he was also a good friend of Woodward, so I met him there. And I was very interested in him because he was very different in many respects from Woodward, and in an important way. If I could sort of simplify the thing, I would say that Woodward worked on very intellectually challenging problems that were not always terribly important. They were more very interesting puzzles, you know, some particular structure. It didn't open up things to the extent that perhaps one could, whereas Todd was very different. He was not the puzzle-solving intellect that Woodward was, but he had exquisite taste in working on projects that really would make a difference, like figuring out what was the structure of vitamin B12, you know, this complicated thing, and figuring out how to make nucleic acids, and, you know, things of this kind, which really made a huge difference. And so that appealed to me a lot, to see that part of chemistry also. And so I did that. So I went with him as a postdoc for a year with some fellowship. There was another reason to do it. At that time, I forget which war we were fighting, probably the Korean War, God knows what. But anyhow, they were drafting people unless they really looked as if they were still continuing their studies. And if you took a postdoctoral out of the country, everybody realized that was not a job, that was a study thing. And so I thought it was very desirable to take a postdoc out of the United States because I didn't feel like ending up shooting Koreans. I suppose that was considering the fact that my father was such a patriot, I suppose that was a bad reaction on my part. But I really didn't appeal to me to do this. And so so I thought if I took a postdoctoral out of the country, that would make a difference. And there were fellowships available to do that, so I did that. And at that point, then when I was going to leave for England, then my wife and I, my now wife, decided we should get married because I didn't want to leave her behind. And in those days, nobody would dream of traveling with a woman who was not his wife.
Oh,
you know,
right.
They were considered to be extremely immoral. You know? In fact, it was funny, even after we were married and we would check, she had by then a passport and her maiden name. So when we would check into hotels, sometimes these hotels would list us as being in separate rooms, so there would be no scandal about people with different names in the same room. It was a different world.
What type of work did you do with Todd?
Well, there I did two things. I worked on the nucleic acid business, trying to devise new methodology for making DNA, which in fact, that I made pretty good progress with, and eventually one of the postdocs in that lab went off on his own and develop my thing further, and it is one of the ways you can link DNA. Nitrophenyl phosphate ester exchange was what I dreamed up that would work. That did. But the other thing I did is I started my own independent work. I mean, one of the reasons I went with Todd also is that he had worked on determining the structure of thiamine way back and has done a lot of work in his lab on thiamine. And I knew I wanted to solve this puzzle of how on earth this thing worked, and I thought having access to these compounds would save me a lot of time, you know, just going to a place where they had a shelf full of all kinds of thiazole derivatives and would let me work on this project. So he was pretty, you know, since I came with my own money, he was pretty good about it. I mean, he didn't worry too much that I was working on his project with one hand but working on my own project with the other, which is what I did. So I started working on the thiamine business there, and it was helpful to have some of his compounds, frankly.
You've already told me how you met your wife. Since you brought her up, what influence has she had on your career? Did she continue to work in science?
Yeah. She what happened? She went with me to England. She started off to get a PhD in biochemistry at Harvard, but of course, obviously, we got married, and she came with me to England, where she was sort of did a postdoc without benefit of PhD. She found a lab where she could work, and she did really some nice work there, I must say. It was very good. And then when we came back, when we came to New York, then it was pretty clear that there were a lot of choices where to go. And she actually went back to New York University, where she had been, I guess, an undergrad. No, she'd been an undergraduate at Cornell. She must have started something at NYU and then transferred to Harvard. And she went back to NYU and finished her PhD. And then she went to Cornell. She had an interesting case. Her PhD thesis, unpublished, which is absolutely criminal, was not her fault, the guy who she's working with, was the first demonstration of poly-A, poly-U binding. I mean, the whole thing that was so critical to understanding base pairing, mm-hmm. she was the one who showed that. Because at that point, Ochoa had just developed methods for making things like poly-A and poly-U. Ochoa was at...
I must be wrong on this.
Oh, no, it was Ochoa. Sorry, Ochoa was at NYU. Exactly right. Yeah, Ochoa had just developed this methodology for making these compounds, and she started doing the physical studies on them and showed this binding association, what it was getting between these materials, you know, that AU recognition was. Never got published. Absolutely nuts. Anyhow, then she went off as a postdoc at Cornell, where she worked with a protein chemist, and he then left, but she stayed on then there and inherited his lab and inherited the grant, more or less, and eventually was put on the faculty there, not too far after that, and is now a full professor there and was, in fact, acting chairman of the biochemistry department a few years ago. So she's still actively working as a professor of biochemistry, still working on proteins, and she's a protein chemist. She's very interested in small molecule binding to proteins. Mm-hmm. So that has been a very good interaction. I mean, certainly I've learned a lot of things from her, and I think she, frankly, has learned things from me. Yeah, so it's worked very well, actually.
Yeah, so yeah. You've been doing...
Right.
So you have two children.
Both attorneys. one of them went to Harvard and thought she might be a scientist. Was completely turned off by freshman chemistry. Luckily, as I told you, I never took that course, so it didn't do me. I should have told her not to take it either. But anyhow, she was completely turned off by freshman chemistry and decided she couldn't believe the kind of thing that the people were teaching. It was so repellent. So she switched instead, became a history major, went to law school here at Columbia. That time, and still true, I think, the Columbia kids get free tuition in the graduate schools and professional schools and everything. So she went to Columbia Law School. And she's now a partner in one of the good, small sort of boutique New York law firms. Mm-hmm. And has had a lot of offers from the big, not-so-boutique places to move, which she's turned down. So she's here in New York as an attorney. And then the younger girl, she never had any great interest in science.
The older one is?
Stephanie. The older one is Stephanie, okay. Yeah. And then the younger one, Karen, she never had any great interest in science, but... She went to Cornell. So Stephanie went to Harvard, which is where I had been an undergraduate, and Karen went to Cornell, and that was a sort of an interesting thing in a way, because she went there then as a faculty child, because my wife was on the faculty of Cornell here in New York. So 200 miles away, you're still a faculty kid. I mean, a very good thing with completely free tuition and that sort of stuff. So that was, you know, very nice. But Cornell was a very good place for her because it had a range of stuff. I mean, you could do everything there. So she started off thinking she wanted to go into business, and. And so she took sat in on some courses, started to take some courses in various things about business, and found them really repellent. And then eventually found that there was a course in the philosophy of law taught by the law school people there for undergraduates. And she took that, she thought that was terrific. So she decided, okay, she'll just go to law school, but then she'll use that as a way to get into business, because she still thought she wanted to do that. And then when she was here at Columbia Law School, at one point... she was taking a course in litigation. At one point, the instructor called her in and said, well, my partner and I have discussed this, taught by two people, and we've agreed that you are the greatest natural litigator we've ever seen. So at that point, needless to say, her head got completely turned, and she went into litigation, where she absolutely was sensational, and was for a long time litigating with Paul Weiss here in New York, and they hated to see her go, but she really wanted to do entertainment litigation. She said... She didn't care which bank won, and so how can you throw yourself into a thing
right.
like that? Who cares who wins? So she decided to, she was really interested in entertainment law, because she also had a very good voice, and she had sung with small groups and things like that. So, you know, she knew a lot of that stuff. So she figured she could put her hobby and her business together. And so she went to entertainment law in California. She had Clint Eastwood as a client, and so, you know, she was really doing good stuff. But she discovered that while the clients were interesting, the law was stupid. It was people arguing about whose dog bit home and, you know, things of that kind. It was just not interesting law. So then she left that and went into regular litigation, and at some point she married and decided she really needed time, and litigators can end up sitting in Las Vegas for 6 months. They never know what's going to happen to them, and it's just no life. So she went so-called in-house, and she became an attorney with Sony Pictures, and she's now vice president for litigation. I mean, she shot right up over everybody in the place.
Terrific.
Because she's a young kid, and she's still running the place now. It's not bad.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel pretty good about these kids. And she's about to produce my first grandchild in a little less than a month now.
Both of us are going to be first grandfathers.
Yeah, it's about time.
My daughter's about to have a baby, too. Yeah. So. When and how did you receive the call to Columbia?
Well, I was sitting in Cambridge, and England, as a postdoc, and I was applying to various places, and I asked Gilbert Stork, because I had worked with him as an undergraduate, I'd done undergraduate mm-hmm. research, I asked him if he would write letters for me, and so at some point, I got a telegram from, I think I had an offer from Bill Johnson at Wisconsin, you know, which was at the time a very strong place.
Right.
So I had an offer from Wisconsin, and so I asked Stork to write something, and back came a telegram saying, do nothing, do you hear from us, or whatever, and then back came an offer to Columbia. Now, it turned out, I think they offered me a job that didn't exist. I mean, I think this was a strictly Storkian kind of operation.
This is the same story I got from Louis Hammett about you.
Yeah, right. I think this thing didn't exist, this job.
Right.
But somehow or other, they had some money from somewhere. I think they had some money from a DuPont gift or whatever, and they offered me this job nonetheless. And I had no great interest, but I had spent some time at Columbia. One summer I'd worked with Stork when I was still an undergraduate, when he already had moved here. I think it was the summer after my senior year I worked down here. But anyhow, I had no great interest in it, but I thought, well, okay, at least it's not a bad place to start. And what I didn't appreciate was that it would be rather nice to be close to family, and it turns out it was. I mean, my parents were nearby, and my sister was nearby, and my wife's family were here. You know, so Thanksgiving was a huge thing, and that was really pretty good. So I ended up here and into this non-existent job, and I was here, I guess, maybe it was my third year that the people at Cornell offered me. I was an instructor, and they offered me an associate professor job, and so I just told the chairman about this, and they had an emergency meeting here, and they popped me up. So I never was an assistant professor. I went from instructor to associate professor with tenure. They just jumped that. Of course, nobody starts as instructor now, so that's perhaps less of a consideration. But so they offered me tenure, so I got tenure after 3 years here. And from time to time, I certainly have considered moving to other places, because at one point, whereas people were convinced that nobody in their right mind would stay in New York, and therefore, clearly, you know, you can steal the people away. And so I got various offers, and there were always factors against it. I mean, some of the factors were, by then my wife's job was pretty good. The fact that we had all this nice family contact was pretty nice. And frankly, New York's an interesting place. And the faculty here are pretty interesting. I mean, I thought Stork is a kick and a half to have as a colleague. I mean, he's always doing crazy things, but they're amusingly crazy things, you know? Mm-hmm. And obviously he's a brilliant scientist. And so that was not bad. So one thing led to another, and I just decided to stay here. But the so-called call was pretty peculiar. Louis Hammett mentioned this at some point.
One of the things he said is Stork tipped us off to Breslau, and then he vaguely remembered using some company's money earmarked for research to put you in a research position for a year until you could be appointed to a faculty line. So your first publications were on the Feynman problem, and you've already told me how you got interested in it. Somehow or other, I didn't get a chance to look at the first paper, which was in Chemistry and Industry, and apparently you put it on mechanism, and it may not have been the right mechanism.
Yeah, no, it wasn't the right mechanism. I put in a mechanism based on essentially the activities. I mean, I tested a lot of different compounds for which things would catalyze. It turns out it had been discovered in Japan during the war, published in Japanese, that thiazolium salts would catalyze the benzoin condensation. Mm-hmm. And so I knew this thing existed. I found somebody who could read Japanese, got the thing translated. This is when I was a postdoc in England. And so I could see what these characters had actually done. And then just set to work trying to see which compounds were catalysts and which were not. And based on that, I concluded that the reaction must be at the so-called methylene group that sits on the nitrogen of the thiazolium ring, because without that methylene, it was never a catalyst. It turns out that the reason for that is that anything other than the methylene there either is not electron withdrawing enough, it was a sort of a benzyl group, or it blocks the active site. And so that proposal that the methylene, I came up with a perfectly good mechanism by which the methylene could be a catalyst, and to some extent, there was precedent in the literature for acidities of the methylenes on benzyl pyridinium compounds and things like that. That CH2 can be ionized. The guy named, I think, Langenbeck was the one that did that. Anyway, so I had a pretty reasonable mechanism, but of course it did not have the critical evidence in its favor. And then Frank Westheimer was a much more sophisticated mechanistic chemist than I was at that point, and he realized you had to test this with the deuterium, and he discovered that that methylene didn't exchange. And so he published something saying, well, this is baloney, obviously it can't be going on there because that methylene is not, in fact, acidic enough to handle the mechanism. So then I came back here to work on the thing seriously and tried various things again and eventually concluded that the hydrogen in the thiazolium ring must be acidic, even though there was no previous real evidence for any such thing. Mm-hmm. We had an infrared spectrometer here. I put the thiazolium salt into D2O and discovered that what was a fairly strong CH band seemed to shift into the carbon deuterium region. So I said, well, that's pretty good. And then Ben Daly had a homemade 30 megahertz NMR machine here that you tuned by inserting a screwdriver into a hole in the back and fishing around till you found something that it would engage with and then turning it, you know. A typical physical chemist idea of a machine, you know, no labels on anything, you have to be a mechanic to run the damn thing. Anyhow, this thing existed up there, and so we put the thiazolium salts into D2O, and there was a CH hydrogen that disappeared, and that was the one, you know. I was able to show that was the one. So that's how the thiamine business got started. Yeah, so the first paper published by me alone out of England was certainly not right in chemistry and industry. But I think from then on, the rest of it seems to have been. You know,
right.
Yeah.
Now, this approach was certainly more physical organic than would be expected from somebody who came out of Stork and Woodward.
You got it.
And so,
yeah.
But you've already said that you had these courses with Westheimer.
I had courses, but I never actually worked with any of the physical organic people. I mean, it was very strange in a way. Every once in a while you see stuff like this. There are people out there in the world who are doing things so close to the kind of stuff I do that everybody assumes they must have worked with me, but they didn't. You know, I mean, sometimes people just go into a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's obvious that, I really didn't want to do this structure business. I mean, it was very tough stuff. You could bang away at it and you could end up with nothing much, you know.
Right.
It didn't seem to me the best place to do things. So, but anyhow, I was just interested in understanding how that thing worked, and that obviously was a big influence.
So you were more interested in the problem as opposed to...
Yeah, I was not so much saying, let's do a physical organic problem, what should we do? What I did was to say, how on earth does this thing work? And then mm-hmm. here is a reaction it catalyzes in solution that has the electronic characteristics of what it does biochemically. Mm-hmm. And if we can understand the solution thing, we'll understand the rest of it. And that wasn't clear either. And it took a while before I realized, after I sort of eliminated other possibilities, that it must be that hydrogen on the carbon between the nitrogen and the sulfur of the thiazolium ring must be acidic. And once, if you ever made that anion, of course, it would look like a cyanide ion and it would do the benzoin type chemistry, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty clear that if that were acidic enough, then it would be able to do it. So after we saw that, then we made various intermediates and showed that they were active and all, you know, that kind of stuff. You know,
right.
And all the things
like
that.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because you also mentioned that Westheimer was looking at the thiamine action in 1956, and he was looking for proton exchange, just as you said.
Well, he was just checking our thing.
But he was convinced that it was somewhere else, perhaps in the other ring.
Yeah, the Pyrimidine ring. Yeah.
Well. Here's a quote from an interview that I did with him in 1979. I'm going to leave it with you. You'll look at it, because he just felt he was so stupid, because apparently a graduate student had said to him, I think it's at the 2 position, or the data looks like that, and Frank just ignored it.
Well, and that's interesting.
And afterwards he felt really
well, you know, what happened
terrible
there?
About it.
Yeah, well, you know, but it was not, I don't think it was his but the thing about it, which was of course an important thing which one should notice, nature doesn't do things for completely bizarre reasons. There were almost no thiazoles around.
Wait a second, something's
So now we now believe this works? How can you tell?
Well,
do little lights flash or what happens?
Yeah, and the dial goes up. I can hear you.
You can hear me. Okay, that's good. All right.
Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, at almost the same time, though, we did this cyclopropenol cation business. Huh?
Yes. That was the next thing I was going to ask about. Actually, someone called to my attention the fact that exchange in the thiazolium ring was done in 1937 by a guy at Fordham. Did you know that?
Who had shown that hydrogen exchange?
No, it wasn't. He had studied the hydrogen exchange. And if you go back and look at his data, apparently it really meshes with your data.
Huh.
Well,
that's interesting. You know, that's surprising. At the time, what was relevant to it, there was a decarboxylation of pyridine 2-carboxylic acid, you know, which put a proton on the pyridine and then the carboxylate ion flew off. And so then obviously that pyridine, the anion in the pyridinium ring, it sort of had to be an intermediate in that. Mm. That decarboxylation we found when we started to think about this thing. We looked back and we said, oh my God, there's this reaction. But I didn't know about the deuterium exchange at the thiazolium.
Yes.
When was it? I mean,
this was 1937 that he published it.
But that's astonishing. I mean, the deuterium wasn't around that long.
Yes, it was. I mean, he
must have gotten some from Urey.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, he must have gotten the D2O from Urey and looked at it and discovered there was some exchange. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, there are a lot of places where things could exchange. It depends on what he had. If it was a simple thiazolium ring, I agree. Then
no,
that
he
was.
He did it. He did it with vitamin B1.
Oh, did he?
He did it with both synthetic and because I guess he had access to synthetic vitamin B1 at the time.
Well, that's interesting. No, I certainly didn't know that. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. Well, every once in a while, you can find stuff like that. I think the Diels Alder business that we did with in water, which everybody thinks, well, you know, we discovered that water thing on Diels Alder, but somewhere you can find some case where somebody else did it. You know, I think there's also some example of that somewhere. You can usually find a thing like that somewhere if you look.
Right.
Certainly weren't aware of it, and I don't think anybody else was either. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The 1958 publication. On Thiamine, you thank Edward McNellis and Rudy Winter for assistance.
Ed McNellis was a graduate student who had not done enough of it that he could really be part of the full paper. Rudy Winter was an undergraduate who worked with me.
Okay.
McNellis is now at NYU, I guess, you know, in chemistry. He was my first PhD student. And Rudy Winter is at, went on to get a PhD and is now University in St. Louis, well, the University of Missouri, I guess, St. Louis, chemistry department also. Mm-hmm. So they both went on, yeah. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned just a minute ago your first paper, 1957, on cyclopropenol cation.
Yeah.
This was obviously something also you had been thinking about. How did you happen to get into the business of non-benzamide aromatics?
Well, yeah, there again, what had happened is when I was reading something or other, I don't know what, something by Ingold at some point in the library in England, and he was proposing a mechanism in which a cyclopropenol anion had to be an intermediate. And by then I was aware of various things that had been done on Huckel and non-Huckel compounds, and thought it was pretty unlikely that this 4-pi electron system would be formed all as readily as the Ingold thing suggested. And for some reason, and which I really don't remember why I did this, when I came back here, I started to work on the question of the cyclopropenol anion, which we did with a student, Merle Batiste, actually. But then I also started working with a couple of undergraduates, decided to go after the cation, because by then I knew Jack Roberts had published a lot of molecular orbital calculations on non-benzenoid things, and it was, you know, the cyclopropenol cation was clear, and I thought that we could come up with a decent way to make it. So that, of course, was more just a synthetic challenge of how to make this crazy thing.
Right.
You know? But, you know, I don't know. I don't know how one gets interested in these things except that they seem to be areas where one doesn't understand enough and where I got so used to the idea with Woodward that everything could be understood. I mean, he was such a rational person that obviously I was not prepared to tolerate situations where one didn't exactly know what the properties would be of a thing of that kind. Mm-hmm. By then, I think one knew about the Tropilia mine. It existed. I guess I hadn't appreciated sufficiently at that point, but maybe I did. But there were no other examples except 6-pi-electron cases for single rings. I mean, naphthalene is 10, but it's 2 rings, so it's unready to count, you know. But in terms of the Huckel business, the Huckel rule for monocyclic compounds, only 6 had actually existed at that point. Cyclic tetramine dianion, for instance, came later, you know, that sort of thing. So we went after this. I went after originally the triphenyl, and I think that was an interesting case because, as I remember, the first ACS meeting I went to, so possibly, maybe it was a year after I got here, or maybe even less, I don't know. But anyway, the first ACS meeting I went to, I had a tremendous mob of people listening to the talk of this kid because the rumor had gone around that we had made this, some derivative of this fundamental cation. Mm-hmm. And so Don Cram, I remember, was there congratulating me. I mean, it was really quite a heady experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it really turned into an entire program.
Yeah, well, sure. And in fact, it's a program that's still not stopped. I mean, I'm still really quite interested in making a decent isolable derivatives of anti-aromatic systems with ground triplet states so that we can really look at the properties of these ground triplets, especially the solid-state properties, you know, the materials properties. There are some theories that electron exchange involving a singlet and a triplet can be used to organize a ferromagnetic domain, and so we're really quite interested in that still.
But these things have very short half-lives now.
No,
so
they don't.
You can make things that are longer live now.
Well, they live forever. Yeah, they live forever. Oh, sure. The anti-aromatics. Oh, sure. It depends on what you make. Cyclobutadiene doesn't last because it dimerizes, but a cyclopropenyl anions, they have not been made for as long-lived species. Benzene dications, we have a hexamino benzene dication that lives forever. You know, it's a triplet. Okay. A cyclopentadienyl cations, these things are okay at very low temperature, frozen, you know, temperatures. There's not a good room temperature one yet, but we're bloody close to one, frankly. So they don't, in principle, see, they're not going to dimerize if they have a charge, and they don't just fragment or explode or whatever. You know, they're not very stable, but compared to what? So if you put substituents on, you can stabilize them.
You collaborated in a number of instances, first with Willie Reinmuth, and then Ed Wasserman and Martin Saunders, and I didn't realize that you knew these people from before. But
well, Willie Reinmuth I knew, of course, because he was here,
right.
And we started there. I mean, at some point, we were interested in the possibility of using electrochemistry as a way to determine the energies of, as you say, very unstable species like cyclopropenyl anions. And of course, all you have to do is pump 2 electrons into a cation to get an anion. So the question is, were there electrochemical techniques that could be used to get thermodynamic information on that? Mm-hmm. And Willie was an expert. I mean, I think the fundamental thing we wanted to do was ours, but Reinmuth was an expert in electrochemistry, so of course he was a great help, and so we did collaborate with him on how to get this stuff going. And at one point he had a student who had worked here, I knew about this work, on a technique called second harmonic AC voltammetry, which was at that time the best way to do really fast sweeps and get reversible potentials of unstable species. And so we adopted that technique and used that to characterize these things. Yeah, no. I think we may have published with Willie Reinmuth only once or so. I don't remember how much we published with him. At that time already, I think he was in some trouble. And partly, I was interested in trying to keep him going. You know, his science had sort of faded away to some extent. He eventually quit doing anything. And we had projects where it was clear that his expertise would be helpful, mm-hmm. but it was also partly, frankly, just to keep him engaged. You know, in the things and that sort of stuff. Ed Wasserman, of course, no such thing was required with Ed. In the case of Ed, what happened is that we. we were convinced we had a triplet species, the pentaphenylcyclopentadienyl cation, because the NMR suddenly disappeared when you made the cation, and so we thought, well, we must have a triplet here. And so then the question is, where can one find that out? And by then, Ed at Bell Labs was already doing triplet ESR carbenes and things of that kind. And so I called him up and just said, well, look, we have this thing. And he said, so we arranged it. We went down there and did these experiments there. And so that was good. And Martin Saunders, the only thing we did with Saunders was when we went for the parent cyclopentadienyl cation itself, simply mixing, we had by then developed a way to make monohalocyclopentadienes, like monochloro, monobromo, you know, on sitting on saturated carbon, and things didn't rearrange yet. And so it was clear if we could pull them off somehow, or other we'd get the parent cation. But all mixing, simple mixing experiments didn't work. But then Martin was at that point doing things where he was shooting a Lewis acid in and a substrate and getting reactions on a cold surface. And so we decided to ask him to get involved in this thing, and so we did that with him. And then Mike McBride at Yale was also doing